ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकदा मह्यं ददाति स्वपदान्तिकम्। वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरौ श्रीयथापदकमलं श्रीगुरुन्नवैष्णवंश्च श्रीरूपं सार्वजातं सहगणरघुनाथन्वितं तं सजीवम् साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनसहितं कृष्णतैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपादां सहगणललिता शिवशखन्वितंश्च। हे कृष्णकरुणासिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेशगोपिकाकान्त राधाकान्त नमोऽस्तुते। तप्तकाञ्चन गौरङ्गी राधे वृन्दावनेश्वरि वृषभानुसुते देवि प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये। पञ्चाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यः च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौरभक्तवृन्द। हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। The story so far is that Lord Vishnu appeared from one of the nostrils of Lord Brahma, who has four heads and who sits on top of the universe on a lotus flower. Though coming out in a very small form, he gradually expanded himself to become very big. And now he's roaring very loudly, just like a mountain roars. So our dear enemies, the mundane scholars, they will not believe this. We're very glad they won't believe this. Not glad for them, but we're glad that they won't understand this. They don't have entrance into this. Yeah, our dear enemies, the mundane scholars, won't believe this, for which we are glad. Not glad that they won't understand it, but glad that they have no entrance into this subject matter. Now, it doesn't seem very rational or logical or realistic that this could be actually true. If we say that God, the Supreme Person, appears in the form of a pig, that in itself they won't like to believe. And when we say he comes from someone's nose, they won't believe that. And they'll say, I won't think God is like that. Very good. God is appearing as he likes, not in the way that our friends, the mundane scholars, like. Or even there may be so many religionists with an incomplete conception of God who won't accept this. Even to accept the form of God, even in the Bible it's said that man is created in the image of God. But many people can't even accommodate that within their minds, how God can be a person with a form. Even if we present, here is the form, Krishna, beautiful, smiling, two hands, holding a flute, dressed in yellow clothes, they won't like to accept that. So they'll say that God is some light or power, God is all goodness. Not God is a person, two hands, two legs, feelings, likes, dislikes. So what to speak of God appearing as a pig? In this way, the Supreme Personality of Godhead defies those who are not faithful, because the beginning of understanding God is acceptance of his inconceivable nature and potencies. If someone says, I believe in God, but I don't believe he could appear like that, or I believe in God, but how can you say God comes as a half man, half lion? Doesn't seem to me that God would be like that. All right. But God is not under your rules. You're under his rules. So you may not like, or within your tiny intelligence, to accept that God should be appearing as a pig, or half man, half lion, or as a fish, or as a swan, or as a cowherd boy. Even as a cowherd boy, they find it very difficult. God should be majestic and mighty, sitting on top of a cloud, punishing people. This is their concept. But no, he has his own way of doing things. He is independent. Swarat, the very beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is established that the Supreme Absolute Truth, the Personality of Godhead, is not obliged to anyone. He's not under anyone's rules and regulations. And even though he creates the rules and regulations of this material world, he's not bound by them. Just like by the rules and regulations of this material world, if we are living on this planet, we can't just take a trip out into space and go beyond the coverings of the universe. Now they say they're going to Mars. We don't believe them. We didn't believe them when they said they went to the moon, and now they're saying they're going to Mars. But even we read about Krishna, he went beyond the coverings of the universe in his chariot and went to see Mahavishnu. So that doesn't seem to fit with our experience. It doesn't fit with our experience. If we're going to make a show of going into space, we have to have a big rocket, like a fireworks. They're talking about advanced technology, but you know this fireworks? They light the rocket and it goes pshhh. So exactly the same thing, the so-called space rockets. It's just the same thing. It's just a lot of fire comes out and goes, what is this advanced technology? It's just the same as children playing. Exactly the same mentality also. Children playing. But when Krishna, we read about Krishna, when he goes into space, he goes on a chariot with Arjuna and takes him to see Mahavishnu. And who is that Mahavishnu? Yasyaika nishvasita kala matavalambya jivanti loma vilaja jagadandanatha Vishnur mahan seha yasya kala vishesho govindamadi purusham tamaham bhajami. Mahavishnu is a portion of a portion of a portion of Krishna, the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. Mahavishnu is lying down, asleep, yoga nidra, not in the mode of ignorance, as we sleep, but fully conscious, and when he breathes out, all the universes come from his body and from the hairs, the hole. You can't, there's a hole where your hair comes out. You can't see it. It's so small. But perspiration comes out, so there must be some hole. But when Mahavishnu breathes out from these holes, universes come. And when he breathes in, universes go in. Now our logician is shaking his head. We don't believe these things. Good. You don't believe. That means you're disqualified from understanding the subject matter. You can understand God. It's possible to understand why he appears as a pig. Why does he appear as a pig? Well, why does he do anything? Because he wants to. Everything he does simply for his own pleasure. He doesn't have to. He appears for certain purposes in this world. We have guna avatars, lila avatars, they all have some specific function. But the main reason he appears is simply for his own pleasure. He likes to do it. Again, the people will ask, why does Krishna play a flute? He likes to. He's God, he can do what he likes. You don't have to tell him. Or you can't tell him, I don't think God should play a flute. Well, you're not God. You're under God. You have to do what he says, not that he will have to do what you say. Not that Krishna will be playing with Radharani and all of a sudden he says, I just got a phone call from Oxford University and they told me that they don't think that I should be playing with the gopis because it's immoral. Okay, close everything down. Go back home and I'll be a good boy from now on. And he's not under your rules and regulations. He does as he likes. And everything he does is good. There you cannot understand. Amoghalila. One name of Krishna is Amoghalila. Means there's nothing wrong in anything he does. From your point of view, because you don't know anything about reality, you may think that this is very wrong, Krishna dancing with the gopis. But this is very right. This is the most moral activity in all of creation, that Krishna is dancing with the gopis, because it is a demonstration of the highest standard of devotional service, which is beyond ordinary morality. These are the gopis breaking the mundane morality of being the wives of their husbands and coming to the highest standard of morality, of completely surrendering everything to Krishna. But the materialists won't understand anything about these things because they don't accept the first point of understanding God. They want to understand God, but they don't accept what is the very definition of God. Definition of God, Swarat. He's all-powerful and independent. Therefore, if we think we can measure him by our little stick, we have a 1 meter measure, and we want to measure the Atlantic Ocean. Is it possible? The same Dr. Frog, he's trying to, by his limited experience, examine and define what is the nature of the Atlantic Ocean. He has experience of 1 well, 10 meters deep, 3 meters wide. And he wants to, his whole understanding of bodies of water is limited to 1 well. So when he's told about the ocean, he doesn't believe it because he thinks that all of reality must be with what he can understand. This is his puffed up mentality. He thinks that if I don't understand it, then how can anyone else understand it? Because I'm the most intelligent. If I haven't seen an ocean, then how can there be an ocean? Because I'm the most intelligent person. He is the most intelligent person within his experience. Among all the frogs in the world, Dr. Frog is a highly learned scholar. A very learned and intelligent person. He's very expert in the advanced levels of scientific inquiry and how to catch flies and eat them and other such important subjects. So he's considered the wisest of all frogs. But he's a frog and his knowledge is limited to the well. So what is beyond the well, he can't even begin to talk about it because he doesn't have any experience. That is exactly the point. Because he doesn't have experience, he cannot understand it. Achintya kalu ye bhava na tangs tarkena yoji at prakrite bhiprangta cha. Achintasya tad lakshanam. The Mahabharata, it is stated that the very nature of things, it's just a straightforward statement. That which is achintya, that which is not understandable by the mind, should not be an object of argument. It's nothing, you don't have any grounds to even discuss it or argue about it or try to speculate about it because it's already defined as achintya, that which is inconceivable. So why try to comment on it at all? Actually, some people, even mundane scholars who are more intelligent, they understand this. There are few in this world. I have one book. It's interviews with scientists and they were asked different questions. And one of the questions they were all asked is about the relationship between science and religion. And several of them wrote in their reply that they're separate fields. Science deals with that which we can study, and religion deals with that which is beyond our ken, beyond our scope of knowledge, beyond our scope of analytical study. So that was pretty intelligent for a mundane scientist. They understood that there are, and actually it is a logical point to understand, that there may be many, maybe and almost certainly are many, many fields of knowledge that we have no access to. This whole modern science, supposed to be rational, is based on the premise that we can only accept that which we can perceive with our senses. But then why do you presume that all of reality is perceivable by your senses? Is it not more logical to presume that there are many levels of reality, there may be at least, if not are, many, many levels of reality which are beyond our sensual perception? How much can we know living on this tiny planet, in this tiny universe, and we only live for a few years, and we have limited intelligence, and we can't control our senses even. Even though you have a big, big brain, PhD, but we can't control our senses. Big PhDs, they're lecherers and drunkards and so many cases. So how much do we actually know? Even in science, it is accepted, both in relativity theory and quantum theory, not that I know much about them, but this much I have heard from those who do know, that relativity theory accepts, that there may be many levels of reality beyond those which we can perceive. We, at the present time, or with our present senses, we perceive within basically four dimensions. That is, length, breadth, height, those three combined make space, and time, within space and time. But there may be many, many other dimensions of reality that we are not aware of. Quantum theory, also some interpretations of quantum theory, give the idea of parallel universes, that according to their theory, not that we have to accept it, but according to their theory, there may be many universes existing parallel with this one. That means within this space, but in a completely different kind of matter, there are different universes going on that we have no access to, we're completely unaware of them. So if we're actually to be rational, the first thing, if we're going to be rational and logical and scientific, should be to understand that we can't understand everything by our limited brain power. Therefore, to understand that which is beyond our power of immediately understanding, we have to take knowledge from those who know. It's a very simple solution to all the problems of knowledge. They have problems of knowledge in scholastic fields, in all areas. It's not that even in science, people think scientists know so many things, they know everything. But actually, among scientists themselves, they know that they don't tell everybody because then they wouldn't be so popular. But they know that there are many, many things which they don't know. There are many what they call problems in science. They have more problems than they realize. But they accept that there are problems in science. That means there are big gaps in their knowledge, which they just presume. Many times they presume something to be true so that they can make some propaganda that they know something, that they know what things are going on. But actually they don't. Just like there's this big gap in science called the missing link in evolutionary theory, which means when Darwin made his evolutionary theory, they presumed we'll go and dig up a few bones here and there, and like dogs, they dig up bones also. And we'll study these bones, and then we'll be able to prove evolutionary theory. And the problem with this is that they never did. In fact, they dug up a whole bunch of bones which go against their theory, and they dug them up and they buried them again, like dogs. And the findings were buried in university libraries, deep, deep, deep inside. Of course, Sadaputta Prabhu has done a pretty good job of digging them up and digging out these records from the vaults and presenting them to the world. But in all areas of science, just like so many different theories of the origin of the universe that scientists have. The very good theory that God created the universe, they don't consider that very scientific. Actually, it is a very scientific theory. Because what is science? They make a hypothesis. And then they see, they examine whatever they can examine. And then to try and explain it all, they make a hypothesis. And then they go back again to the data and examine it again. They go back and examine the data again and see if they're... Before they had a rough idea and they made a hypothesis, and they see if the examined evidence fits the theory, and they may have to adjust the theory a little bit that way, this way, and then they come up with what they call a scientific law, which by the scientific law it means that everything that they observe should be explainable by that law. So, according to this system, if we see the whole universe, we see millions of stars at night and everything is moving with tremendous synergy. I'm not getting the right word. Harmony? Yeah, that's a good word. So, how is it all going on? By chance is one. It's not really an explanation. It's more like saying I don't know, but you don't want to say I don't know. Just like if I ask who put this here, this microphone stand, and you say, you don't want to say I don't know, and so you say, well, it got there by chance. just by chance, that's all. Just happened to be there. How did this building come into existence? Who designed it? Who built it? Who put the money up to build it? Well, I don't know. By chance. It all happened by chance. One day there was a big storm and everything blew together. And, you know, some light bulbs. By chance, the glass of the light bulbs came into formation. Some quartz from the sea, by chance, all came together. And there was by chance, there was a big fire burning and it all got smelted together and it came out as glass. And just by chance, the light bulb, or the glass came in this shape. And just by chance, also, some iron ore, which was in the underground, that came out of the ground and got separated from the stone in which it was, and it just got shaped in exactly that shape, and it fell inside that glass, which also came into being by chance and just came in that shape. And then the cap came on it, and it doesn't make any sense, does it? That's only the light bulb. What to speak of the whole house? If we say it all came into being by chance, who will believe it? Then what to speak of the whole universe? And this house, you can design it and build it. You have enough intelligence to do that. Taking the iron ore from the ground, purifying it, putting it in a particular shape. You have enough intelligence to do that. You can design a house. Very good. But what about the whole universe? It's so complex. Even one cell within our body, the most simple cell, is more complex than even a big modern city, what to speak of one house. And then how all the cells interact with each other. Then how all the different bodies interact with each other, how the different planets and the planetary influences all work together. So if we say by chance, it doesn't seem to be a very good theory. Actually, it's absurd, it's nonsense. It doesn't make any sense. Just like if we say the light bulb came into existence by chance, who will believe it? If they have this theory, well, if you give it enough time and enough possibilities, it could come into being by chance. And they give the example. If you had enough monkeys, if you brought all the monkeys in the world and all the typewriters in the world and let them sit in the room with the typewriters and run around here and there, and you had paper in the typewriters, of course someone, not by chance, would have to keep on changing the paper. But eventually, in course of time, they would type out all the works of Shakespeare. That is their theory. Of course, even then there are some preconditions that you'd have to put the monkeys in the room with the typewriters. And who made the typewriters? Are you lost? You know, we're talking nonsense here, so it may be difficult to translate. If it doesn't make any sense, don't worry. So, but even then, can you believe that in course of time, by just jumping around on typewriters, all the works of Shakespeare would come out exactly with all the commas, all the spelling exactly correct, with all the commas in the right place, the full stop, the punctuation in the right place, the paragraph break, everything in the right place. Just like if you left enough monkeys for a long enough time, don't worry, it's all nonsense. You can tell them. You can't hear? I'm not speaking loudly enough?
No, it's a little bit too fast for me.
Okay. Just like if we left enough monkeys to play around in a place where there was iron ore, and we left them for millions of years, do you think they would make even they would extract the iron from the iron ore and fiddle around with it enough to make one filament exactly correct for a light bulb? What to speak of putting it inside the glass, which also has to come about by their chance fiddlings around? It's nonsense. It doesn't make any sense. But they're teaching these things. So we have a different theory, a different hypothesis. Okay, take it as a hypothesis that there is a supremely intelligent and powerful being who designed everything, put everything in place, and holds it together. Because even if we say everything has come into being by chance, then how is it still going on by chance? We see that in nature there is a regenerative principle that for instance, when we cut ourselves, then the body, I don't say, but within the body, there is some mechanism to for the blood to clot and for it to heal. And throughout nature we see that. If you chop the forest down, it will come back again. Nature regenerates. So how is this all going on? If you take it as a hypothesis that there is a supremely intelligent controller behind this all, everything fits the hypothesis very nicely. All the evidence fits it very nicely. There's only one problem with this theory, that Dr. Frog didn't see that highly intelligent controller. Therefore, he doesn't believe it. All the evidence is there. Just like in a crime, sometimes someone is convicted. No one saw him stab that person to death. But by circumstantial evidence, you knew, it was understood that these two people were enemies, they hated each other, they were always arguing. That man was seen picking up a knife and walking towards his house. He was seen walking out 5 minutes later. When they went inside the house, they found his enemy dead with the same kind of knife that he walked into the house with. Of course, it could have been a different knife, but it looked exactly, it's exactly the same kind of knife. He was covered in blood. There were his fingerprints on the knife. So no one saw him commit the murder. But by circumstantial evidence, it has to be concluded that this man is the culprit. So that is accepted, even in a court of law. So if we can't see God, does that mean there's no God? Can you not accept circumstantial evidence? People say, show me God. Let me see God. You can see by this method, by circumstantial evidence. Actually, you can see God. We are meant to see God. But we have to become purified to see God. Otherwise, even if you see Him, you cannot recognize Him. Just like people ask us, show us God. We will say, yes, here is God. And they will say, this is not God, this is a statue. Because they do not know what is the nature of God. That God, if He wants, He can take the form of the deity. And He does want. Therefore, He comes in the form of the deity. Those who are devotees, when they see the deity, they don't see a statue. They see Krishna. Those who are non-devotees, they may not even see the deities. They'll come and they'll see and they'll say, oh, very nicely decorated. Lots of flowers, very nice. And they don't even see the deity. Because they're so much unfaithful. They don't have eyes to see. I've had this experience of showing someone and they said, oh, everything very nice, but they couldn't see the deity at all. So you can see God. You have to become qualified to understand, to see God. And the qualification is that one has to be His devotee, because He's such a great person. If we accept, hypothetically, there is a supreme controller, designer, then do you think you can just say, show Him to me? Just like if you want to see the prime minister of this country. I don't believe in that guy whose name I forget, something like Mataji, something like Mataji. So I don't believe in this guy. I don't believe he exists. Well, there's so much evidence. So many people have seen him. I don't believe them. You can see his photograph. It's all a fabrication. Show him to me. Do you think he's going to, oh, someone in Rijeka doesn't believe in me. Quickly, drop all the business. Get in a car, drive there and fall at his feet and say, here I am, the Prime Minister. Please, please believe in me. He's not going to run to you. He's coming to you out of his kindness and presenting himself. Here I am Krishna. You don't believe I'm God? All right, universal form. Shishupal, you don't believe I'm God? Okay, off with your head. He's showing he's God. That is not only personally coming, but it's in so many ways, it's obvious that Krishna is God. This Yamuna Acharya has commented. Tvam Shila Rupa Charitai Parama Prakrishtai Sadvena Satvatiya Prabhalaischa Shastrai Prakyata Daiva Paramata Vidaischa Chayamcha Naivasara Prabhatavo Pradyanti Kaman. This means that it's obvious, he says, Yamunacharya says, that it's obvious that Krishna is God. It's by his activities, it's accepted by all the acharyas who are expert in the mode of goodness. They proclaim Krishna to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. His character, everything he does, is completely clear that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But those who are demons, they cannot understand it, because they are demons. That is their disqualification. Nahang prakasha sarvasya yogamaya samavrita mudo yang nabijanati loko mama jamavyam. Krishna doesn't reveal himself to the demons. There's a qualification to see God and to understand God. Not that you can just demand, show me God. There's a qualification. You can see, but you have to be trained how to see. Just like if you want to understand any subject matter, science, you have to be trained how to understand it. If you'll see, there may be some scientific experiment. So a layman, if he sees it, he won't understand it. To him, it's just some chemicals and some tubes and some glass pots. He doesn't understand what's going on. He sees, but he doesn't see. He doesn't see what's going on. But a trained scientist sees, oh yes, now they are reacting some chemicals to make some other chemicals. He understands. Seeing, actual seeing, means to understand. When you understand, then you see. Just like, I don't know in your language, but in English, if you understand something, you say, I see. Do you say that in your language also? No. In English, you say that someone may say something. I'm going to London because I have some work there. I see. In English, you say that. It doesn't mean that he's seeing you going to London. I mean, he understands. He's understood the point. That's why we have to see, in understanding spiritual subject, we have to see through our ears. Shrutikshana. This is mentioned in this canto of Bhagavatam. We have to see by hearing is our eyes. Just like you see the deity. But unless you hear, this is Krishna, then you cannot understand. But how do you have to hear? You have to hear with faith. Otherwise, if you don't have faith, even if someone explains, yes, this is the deity, he is Krishna, by his desire he appears in this form. That is another symptom of his greatness, that even though he's greater than the greatest, he becomes small so that you can handle him, you can serve him in this size. If he comes as Mahavishnu, then you can't serve him. You can't accommodate him. A universal form, you can't accommodate. But this size, you can dress him, you can feed him. And I say, how can he eat? He's a metal statue. He can eat. He's not a metal statue. He's God, and he eats. And those who are devotees, they see him eating. There are many cases. Raghunandan Thakur, his father told him, because his father was going away, now you have to make the offering, feed him. So he brought the offering and said the prayers. And he's watching, he's not eating. What's wrong? What's wrong with me? You don't like me? I offered it to you, why don't you eat it? And if you don't eat it, my father will be upset, because he told me to eat it, eat it. And Krishna had to eat, because his devotee was forcing him, you have to eat. So anyway, he's eating. By his eyes. And again he leaves it. Devotees, they can see. Madhavendra Puri, when he installed Gopal deity, he saw how Krishna was eating and again leaving everything as his remnants. So devotees, they can see because they hear with faith. The beginning of understanding is faith. If we don't have faith, then we can't begin to understand. Then people say, oh, then it's just dogmatism. You just have to believe it. But that's not blind faith. It's based upon some intelligent understanding. are intelligent. By our intelligence we should understand God. Not that we can understand God with our intelligence. Does that make any sense, what I just said? We should understand God with our intelligence, but we cannot understand God with our intelligence. So does it make any sense? It doesn't seem to make any sense. That means that God has given intelligence to those in the human form of life. That intelligence is meant to be used to understand God. So basic principles about the nature of God, we can understand by our God-given intelligence. That there is a supreme controller, there is a supreme designer, there is a supreme friend. So these points we can understand. And as it is described in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, how the material world is going on under his direction, maya adhyakshena prakriti suyate sacharachara hitunane na kuntaya jagat viparivartate, how everything is going under his direction, the influence of the three modes of material nature. So these things, to some extent, we can understand with our intelligence. But then, exactly why God should be blue, and in different forms, like this form, God is reddish, the boar incarnation, or sometimes he has the white boar incarnation. Why he should appear as a boar at all? Of course, he had to pick up the earth, so it's a very suitable kind of body. But he doesn't need to. Just by his wish, he can pick up the earth. The earth doesn't have to fall down at all. This is his leela, this is his pastime. He enjoys it. That's as good a reason as any. That's the best of all reasons, because the most important feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is that he is the supreme enjoyer. But with our intelligence, we cannot measure God. With our intelligence, exactly why he does what he does, then we can't describe. That's why people say, I don't believe that God takes the form of a boar. But then, you're not qualified not to believe, because God is not under your jurisdiction. So the devotees, from the very beginning, they accept on faith, that is not blind faith, but that is the faith that is required to enter into the understanding of any subject. Just like in the school, if you're to study mathematics, and someone brings out some big calculation, and starts to explain it, teacher starts to explain, you say, well, I don't believe this. I have my own idea. 2 + 2 = 4? No, I don't believe it. 2 + 2 = 5? Why not? It's a free country, you can say whatever you like. I have a democratic right to believe that 2 + 2 = 5. Well, you have your democratic right to be a fool and an idiot. But it's impractical. It's impractical, just like if you go to the shop and you take 2 apples, and then you take another 2 apples, and then you argue with the shopkeeper, well, why aren't there 5 apples? My belief is that 2 + 2 = 5. So I took 2, I paid for them, and I took 2, and now I should have 5 apples. The person will think you're crazy, which you are. So you can democratically believe whatever you like, but it doesn't mean it's true. The absolute truth stands on its own principles. We are not the arbitrators of the absolute truth. The absolute truth is independent. So our position as tiny living beings is to understand and serve that absolute truth. We cannot control the absolute truth. This is the mistake of the mundane scholars. From the very beginning, their whole approach to knowledge is certain to be unsuccessful, because their very attitude in trying to understand is that they want to dominate and control the knowledge. The mundane scholar, you see mundane scholars, they approach Vaishnavism. I'm going to do a PhD in Vaishnavism in my university. But they cannot understand anything. Even if you'll find some scholars, they can talk to you, yes, Ramanuja's Vishishtadvaita Vad, and they'll give all the different theories within that, Sharia Shariri Bhav, and They can explain the philosophy of Ramanujacharya or Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But they have no actual understanding. It's only superficial. And it's like a parrot can also, if you train a parrot, the parrot can speak 2 + 2 = 5, 3 + 3 = 7. You can train a parrot to speak something. Or it may even be something that makes sense, like 2 + 2 = 4. But if you train the parrot to say 2 + 2 = 4, You may think, well, the parrot is a good mathematician, but he doesn't understand a word. It's just a sound to him. So in the same way, the mundane scholars, they may say, yes, well, Madhva disagreed with Ramanuja, and therefore he presented his Shuddha Dvaita philosophy in opposition to Vishishta Dvaita, but they don't understand a word of what they're talking about. Even though they think they do. They cannot enter into that knowledge because from the very beginning they take it as a subject to study. I will study Vaishnavism and then I will write a theory and make my PhD. But this is not the way to understand that knowledge. They want, in other words, they want to think that I, by amassing facts and figures, then I will understand and I can write some, I will have it under my understanding. That's the whole point. They want to put knowledge of Krishna under them. It is something to be understood by me. But the whole approach is flawed. They want to dominate the subject. But the devotee, he understands by, as Prabhupada said, understanding means standing under. When you become humble and think that I am, Vaishnavism isn't something for me to be studying, just like you study anthropology, mathematics, physics, history, and here's another box called Vaishnavism, and we have all these books in this box, and everything you want to know is in this box, and now you can get it on a CD. And we'll make a CD. Knowledge of Vaishnavism and everything's there. You can't get knowledge like this. The knowledge of God doesn't come like that. Knowledge comes by the submissive process by which God reveals himself to the faithful devotee. The whole attitude, I will understand. You can't understand God by going to university, reading books. You can understand God by service. Atashri Krishna Namadi Navaved Grahyam Indriyai Sivan Mukhe Hi Jivado Swayameva Spuratyada. God reveals himself to those who have a service attitude. By service and by hearing from devotees. By these two things are so much important. The service attitude, that I'm not here to dominate God and say, now I understand everything about Krishna. I've understood this theory. But the service attitude and regularly hearing from devotees. It's not that we say you can't understand God by scholarship. It's not that devotees are not scholars. Devotees are the greatest scholars. Within our sampradaya and in other Vaishnava sampradayas also, we have such great scholars that sometimes we say about our devotees in ISKCON, oh, he's a great scholar and this and that, but compared to the great acharyas, Jiva Goswami, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, their writing is so on such a level that we can't even begin to understand it. We can't even, what they're writing is such a deep level, such a deep philosophical level that you, even if you read it and you look up in the dictionary what all the words mean, and still you can't understand it. Because their whole intellectual level is just, you know, we were brought up on watching cartoons on television, so what are we going to understand about philosophy? It's not possible. Someone who's brought up from the very beginning in a devotional atmosphere and who's trained from a very early age, they may become great scholars by that standard. There's so, you'll see, just like in the Vedic culture, there's so many dissertations on Vedanta philosophy. But nowadays, who can understand all these points? Just on this, tattvamasi, these three words, how many hundreds of books have been written explaining exactly what each word means according to different inflection and context. But nowadays, who's going to study all these things? Even if someone wanted to, who's got the brain to understand all these things? That's where we find when Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went to Ishwarapuri, he got initiated by him. So when you get initiated by your guru, naturally you expect to get some training in philosophy. And traditional training in philosophy is Vedanta philosophy. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked his guru, okay, teach me Vedanta. Murka tumi tomar nahik Vedanta dika. You're just a fool. You're not qualified to understand Vedanta. Krishna mantra japa sada e mantra sha. You just chant Hare Krishna. This is the essence of all Vedic knowledge. So does that mean we shouldn't study at all? No, we should study. Definitely we should study. Sometimes devotees ask, how can I become more advanced? They're very simple principles if we follow them. Rise early, chant the holy names, study Prabhupada's books. So this is one of the basic principles. Study Srila Prabhupada's books. All and everything you need to become fully Krishna conscious is in Srila Prabhupada's books, as Srila Prabhupada has told us. Everything. Everything that you need is in Srila Prabhupada's books. You don't need to read any other books. Of course, Prabhupada's disciples may make expansions of the expansions of the knowledge doesn't mean that there's adding anything, because everything is in Prabhupada's books. But just like, for instance, to bring some points together, to clarify some points, or just out of their devotional ecstasy, devotees may give more commentary. But everything is there in Prabhupada's books. So by this process, Krishna can be understood. It is possible to understand God by this submissive process. Hearing and serving. Giving up the idea that I will understand God by my puffed up academic method. Jnane prayasam udapasya namanta eva jivanti sanmukaritam bhavadiya vartam sthane stita shudigatang tanuvang manobhya ye prayasa jitajito apitaistri lokyam. Lord Chaitanya accepted. He rejected so many processes of self-realization, but he accepted that someone who gives up the puffed-up mentality that I will understand the absolute truth by my own brain power, if someone gives up that mentality, becomes humble, hears from devotees, and dedicates his life in the service of the absolute truth, then he can conquer God. These scholars, they want to conquer God by their scholarship, but they remain forever conquered. They themselves remain ever conquered by material nature. But Krishna is conquered by the love of the devotees who give up the puffed up attitude, serve, take up the service attitude, and hear from his devotees. So this is the process to understand God. And actually, if we simply accept what are the statements of Bhagavatam, then immediately we can understand. The scholars, the mundane scholars, how can we accept there's a big boar? And then they'll try to interpret in some other way. Maybe there was some tribal cult which used to worship pigs, and then later on they wanted to, for social amalgamation, they wanted to amalgamate all these different tribes. So they put the story of the boar being God. They're all different tribes, and some used to worship lions, and some used to worship pigs, some used to worship fish. So they put them all together and said they're all avatars of Vishnu, and in this way for social unity. So they may make different theories. Oh, nonsense. It's amazing, actually, how many amazingly abstruse and nonsense theories they can dream up. But a devotee, he immediately accepts, yes, Krishna is God, he can do whatever he likes. If he wants, he can appear as a boar, he can come out the nose of Brahma, who has four heads. How can you believe he has four heads? Because in Bhagavatam, why not? What do we know? We are only living on a tiny little planet. What do we know what's going on up there? So he appeared like this, and then came out as a huge boar and roared like a great mountain, because great mountains also roar. I didn't see them, you didn't see them, but then I and you didn't see everything in the universe. So how can we say? So we accept. And when you accept it, you immediately understand it. Simply by accepting, you understand. And it becomes simple to understand. Yeah, why not? Of course. Lord Bob, he has appeared like this. Everything becomes straightforward and easy and natural. That's why even a very neophyte devotee who's just beginning, if he has faith in Krishna, he knows more about Gaudiya Vaishnavism than the big scholar, mundane scholar. How can you say that's true? The mundane scholar will explain this, tattvavad, vishishtadvaitavad, Dvaita Advaita, and so many different, explaining all the details, the different categories. And here you have a new bhakta, he can't even pronounce Nama Om Vishnu Padaya, he can't even pronounce it properly. And you say, he knows more. He knows more because he's come to the proper conclusion that he accepts, yes, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And your big, big scholar will write, according to certain philosophers, Krishna is accepted as the Supreme Personality of God. It is said that Krishna is, means they haven't come to that point. And they never can come to the point of accepting Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because they have dedicated their lives to being eternal agnostics and skeptics. And you can never really prove anything, they say. Well, it's proved to us that you're full number one, but you don't accept that, because you think you're so intelligent. So they're always doubting. But those who are doubting, they can never understand. Ashadadhana purusha, dharmasyasya parantava, aprapyamang devartante mrityu sangsara varnani. Those who don't have any faith, then they cannot attain to Krishna. They cannot take up devotional service. But they get taken up on the wheel of birth and death again and again and again. So they're so much scholarly doubting. I doubt this and I doubt that, and we can't really prove. But this is just the scholastic, so-called scholastic pedanticism. Because when it's time for them to eat, they don't sit around making a theory. Well, is it really nourishing? Is it really good food? Should I eat it or shouldn't I? What will actually be? When they're hungry, they take some bread, they put some butter on, and they eat it. They don't go through a whole scholastic analysis. Well, is it nice or is it not? And maybe someone poisoned it. And even though I ate bread every day of my life, maybe this day when I eat it, I'll get dysentery. They don't. You could doubt in so many ways, so many things, but they don't. But when it comes to Krishna, God, oh, we doubt it. But in their practical life, they accept so many things on faith. And by accepting those things on faith, they get the benefit from it. If you sit around looking at a piece of bread, wondering, well, should I eat it or not? Then eventually you'll starve to death. But if you eat it, you get the benefit. You get nourished. So in the same way, you can go on, well, I don't know about this Krishna consciousness. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not, probably isn't. You don't get the benefit. And if you just take it up, you chant Hare Krishna, you follow this process, you get the benefit. You become ecstatic. You understand Krishna, and you go back to Godhead. So everyone has, they say, we don't believe anything. We can't accept it. But they do believe, so many things they believe. They believe when they pick their foot up from the ground, when they're walking, they put it down again, they don't believe that the earth's going to open up and swallow them. They have faith that by putting their foot on the ground, the earth will support them. So many things they believe. Well, they say, well, that we can verify, but there's no verification that, okay, you walked so many days, so many times, you put your foot like this, but there's no proof that next time you lift your foot up and put it down on the ground, that you won't just fall into the ground. Where's the proof? There's no verification. But you accept certain things on reasonable faith. So it's also very reasonable to accept that there is a Supreme Person. It's very reasonable. It's not at all reasonable to accept that there isn't. Otherwise, how do you explain the existence of the universe? And it's very reasonable, there are more reasons, when we see that all the greatest experts in spiritual knowledge, they all accept that point. And they all demonstrate to us a process by which we can enter into the mysteries of understanding that Supreme Person. And very reasonably, it is explained how he creates, maintains, and destroys. So it's not that we're devoid of philosophy. We're not, as some people say, simply mindless robots. You have so much philosophy. We're not just accepting blindly, but we're accepting very reasonably. So actually, it is the non-devotees who are unreasonable. Sometimes these anti-cult people, they don't like these sects. You have this here in this country? Not so much. All right, in other countries they have it. So they say that, well, it's not proper, you're influencing the unformed minds of young people to accept it. But what are they doing? From the very childhood, they put them in school and influence them to believe that they are this body and that sense gratification and acquisition of money is the goal of life. And there are so many advertisements, they're strongly influencing them to buy cigarettes and get lung cancer. But, oh, you shouldn't strongly influence. It's very bad. You're leading people in a certain way. And they're leading them to hell. And we're leading people, even if you're such a rascal, you don't accept any God. And see, these people, they're leading a very good life. They're not harming anyone. A very pure life. That also they don't like. Why aren't they eating meat? Why aren't they taking intoxication? You'll find so many parents, their children, they're regularly taking intoxication, and they don't care. Or if they care, they don't care much. They think, well, that's normal. Everyone's kids does that. But if they join the Hare Krishna movement and stop taking intoxication, oh, very bad. And they're not even watching TV. Oh, terrible. And they become very upset and make propaganda. Mainly, most probably they're upset because other people, their friends and neighbors will say to them, or their friends and neighbors say, see, his children became crazy Hare Krishnas. They're afraid that their friends and they don't care for you, but they care what my friends and neighbors and relatives will say about me. They'll say, because you couldn't bring up your child properly, probably there was some problem at home, therefore he's joined this movement. So it's all selfishness. It's all selfishness. So anyway, we have our own standard. We have to be very much fixed in this, that we accept the standard of transcendental knowledge which is coming from Guru, Sadhu and Shastra. We shouldn't be misled by materialists, just like sometimes we hear really nonsense ideas from people who are supposed to be devotees. Things like, well, if we don't watch TV, then the karmis will think we're unusual. Mm-hmm. And if we don't let our children watch TV, they'll think it's very bad. Therefore, we should have a TV, and we should let the kids watch TV and all this. And then the karmis will think we're nice, ordinary people. Okay, the karmis will think you're nice, ordinary people. But we don't want to be nice, ordinary people going to hell like you. If nice and ordinary means you watch TV and go to hell, then why should we be like that? Why should we allow our children to watch this violence and sex and just absolute nonsense? Tom and Jerry, Mickey Mouse. This is what you want your children to be brought up in? Yes, because that's normal. Everybody else sees that. It's normal, but it's nonsense. It makes no sense.
Gonna pass the stool?
Okay. All right, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to embarrass you. Sorry. We have a different kind of culture. One of the things is you have to learn how to sit. Now they'll say, oh, just see, they're so cruel in our Hare Krishna movement. They make you sit on the floor, no chairs. Now we have a different standard. This is civilized life. Even all this, of course in the Western countries we're accustomed to using furniture, but that it's also not necessary. Real civilization means simple. If you have to have a chairs and beds and tables and all these things, and you have to get some money and you have to work to get them. So the most civilized people in Vedic culture, they're the Brahmanas. And in modern times, we think civilized means you have to have a big apartment and a BMW car and so many different electrical objects. But by Vedic standard, the most civilized person is a Brahmin who lives in a hut with the minimum. He has some water pot and a mat for lying on, minimum things. And his intelligence is used for studying Srimad Bhagavatam. So he has a different standard of culture. Sit on the floor. Eat simple food. Live very simply. Don't need a lot of money. Of course, in the modern age, we're preaching. So for preaching in this world, we also, just like I spent 20 minutes this morning sending a fax. So what am I talking about? Because we, this is the modern age, we're living in the modern world. We have to interact with the modern world to some extent on its grounds so that we can preach in the world. It means to organize preaching all over the world, we have to have books, which means we have to go to printing presses, we have to deal with money, we have fax machines, we have computers. But that doesn't mean that we take up the ideas and philosophy of the materialistic civilization. We deal, as stated in the Nature of Devotion, we deal with the material world as much as is necessary and no more. Only as much as is needed to preach Krishna consciousness. And we have our own standard of civilization. The Prabhupada gave the example, sometimes they ask, why, if you don't believe in all the, you don't, you're saying go to the land, live simply, then why are you using all these things? That example is there. And how do you chop down a tree? With an axe. So the what actually cuts the tree is the blade of the axe. But you can't cut the tree, the axe can't cut the tree unless it has a handle. And what is the handle made of? Wood. So the wood becomes the instrument to chop the wood. So all these computers, technology we're using to destroy that civilization. Destroy means it may have some usefulness, just like the printing presses, they're very good, very nice. When it's used to print Prabhupada's books, very good.